I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This hour, let me take you to the Kasbah, literally. We're going to find out about a woman who, for a very brief period in the 30s and 40s, enchanted the Arab world with her singing, her beauty, and her mystery. Her name was Asmahan. She was both a princess and a seductress, a streetwise woman. She was an actress, a singer. She was spectacularly beautiful. She was also a spy, or so we're told, and a lover, caught between East and West, between cultures and empires. When she died in a mysterious car crash, she was only 26 years old. So this hour we go back to an earlier time, a time of colonial rule of the Levant, to a world where the Brits and the French quarreled over their hold on Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, and Egypt. And perhaps we go back to a time, to a moment, when the cultures of the East and the West were perhaps a little closer than they are today. We invite you along. First of all, do you recall the woman Asmahan? Were you ever under her spell yourself? What can we learn by looking back at a time when the different cultures seemed more interested in each other? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined here in the Boston studio by Leila Ahmed. She is a professor at the Harvard Divinity School and author of numerous books on women and gender in Islam. It's nice to have you back in the Connection studio, Leila.
Lovely to be here.
We also have with us from a studio in Cleveland, Ohio, Sharifa Zuhur. She is a professor of Islamic studies at Cleveland State University and author of a book called Asmahan Secrets, Woman, War, and Song. Sharifa, thanks for being with us.
Hello there.
Now, you hint at it in your book, but you don't come right out and say it. Did you become somewhat obsessed with Asmahan in doing your research?
Very obsessed. I decided to try and trace her steps from birth to death. And along the way, many people told me I was quite crazy for being obsessed with her, and then told me about other people who were obsessed with her.
So the craziness that you were being accused of, was that because people were saying you were never going to be able to separate the myth from the fact in sorting this woman out?
I don't think so. I think people felt that nobody in the West would be interested. Who would want to know about Asmahan, that Arabs regard her as a superstar, but she's also in danger of being lost in history, and that's why I wanted to write the book.
We should give her other name, I suppose, Princess Amal al-Atrash, is that right?
That's correct.
Now, was she a real princess?
The title of prince or princess was actually invented by the French when they assumed the mandate in Syria. But her family, the Al-Atrash clan, they're a noble clan. And there is a division between the nobility and the ordinary people. And, you know, what that meant is they were the most powerful tribe or large family in their area.
Now, in the course of this hour, we thought what we might do is try and get to know Asmahan a little bit through her music. But just before we start that, Sharifa, we should probably just do a quick overview. Hers was quite a riches to rags to riches story. She began as the princess. She ended up in Cairo, a city somewhat unfamiliar to her family, where she sort of picked herself up by her own bootstraps and gained fame and notoriety on the strength of her singing and her looks. Is that fair?
That's fair. It wouldn't be fair to characterize the Jebel Druze, where she came from, as a rich or wealthy area. It wasn't. So, I mean, nobility doesn't always correspond with money. But yes, they were so poor in Cairo that there are all sorts of stories about sleeping wrapped up with newspaper, not having money for rent. Her mother took in wash and She definitely pulled herself up by her bootstraps, as did her brother. So the two of them became superstars.
And Leila, Cairo, 1920, what was it like for women in that city at that time?
Actually, it was a very exciting time because, for the first couple of two or three decades of Egypt, even actually to the end of the Second World War, was a very exciting time because it was a time, if we go back a little earlier from the 1910s and 20s, when the struggle for women's rights was just beginning, schools were flourishing. Egypt was full of schools and colleges for girls and women. Missionary schools, some of them American schools, French and British. So it was a time of opening up. By 1925, one of the upper-class women formally cast off her veil and was photographed doing that in the newspapers.
It was 1925, did you say?
1925, or 24
fabulous.
Even.
Yeah,
by
okay.
1932, the first women graduated from Egyptian universities. So it was a time of tremendous excitement. And also, and you said earlier at the beginning in the introduction that the East and West seemed closer. In fact, they were closer, and Cairo was one of the hubs of these places because under the British, and the British were there from the late 19th century, and the 1910s and 20s were a very good era for all the political oppression because the British had free press in Egypt. So people flocked, Syrians and Lebanese, but also people from Turkey, from Italy and Greece, flocked to Egypt because it was a stable, under the British rule, it was stable. There were free presses, which was the only place in the Middle East which had free presses. You could.
And in simple geographic terms, it was more of a hub point than we see it today because of the British being also in India, and they had all of the South Asia then would funnel through Cairo, and Europe would come through Cairo and North Africa at the same time.
Exactly. And there were many Europeans in Egypt as well at that point. And it was also a place of religious mixing because there were, of course, the native Egyptian Copts and Jews in that era. So that the first, when you're asking about the 20s, the first Egyptian parliament after the independence included Egyptian Jews and Copts as well as Muslims. So it was a time of great excitement, really.
And into this time, of course, comes Asmahan with her singing and her presence on the screen. I wonder if we can listen to the very beginning of one song, Nawait Adari Alami. Did I pronounce that right, Sharifa?
That's fine. Yes.
Okay. You're being very charitable. But there's something of a Western sound that you would have us listen to in the beginning of this. Am I right?
That's correct.
Sort of what? What was the word? A tango?
Actually, that's a different piece. I think you will play a piece with a tango rhythm, but you should listen here for the instrumentation and the line of the music. So the melodic line was changing also, and there's a synthesis of Western and Eastern forms.
Sharifa, that has a very film-like quality to it. Is that specifically from a soundtrack of one of her movies?
No, this is a song. Most of her songs are from the soundtracks of one of her movies. She also performed them in other settings. She performed on the radio,
right,
which was very important, and in private parties. The soundtrack quality had to do with the violins and the way her voice calls and the violins respond, which is a feature of Arabic music, but it was being translated into the different range of melody that the Egyptian and Arab composers heard in Western music, and they borrowed and they interpreted, and there's this fantastic mix there. And they listen to Hollywood movie tracks too.
And then Leila, to the Arab ear, does that have that strong Western sound to it as well, with the orchestra as opposed to the sort of indigenous instruments?
It does have a strong Western sound to my ears compared to, say, Umm Kulthum, who was the contemporary of Asmahan, who had a much more Arabic tradition.
It's a female classic singer of that same era, right?
Yes, that's right.
Let's pick this up a little bit further on in the song, because this is a point where we begin to see just really what this woman can do with her voice. Part of the song, Sharifa, it sounds in a way like a piece of jazz music in this country where someone gets to kind of make up what they're doing. Is that an accurate way of hearing it?
That's an accurate way of hearing it, and this is almost, it's being lost today. So this is a very classical aspect of Asmahan's performance, and one in which she was a master. Just as much as the other singer we mentioned, Umm Kulthum. It is a place in the song that's called the Mawal, and the singer can improvise on syllables, sometimes on a short poem. Sometimes it will be written into the song, as it was in this song, and the singer can take it as many bars as she wants and then go back to the melody. So it is very much like jazz.
Leila, do you remember your parents listening to this music?
Absolutely. I mean, where Sharifa approaches it as a scholar, for me it's all about memory. And it also reminds me, what it evokes is, I guess I'd want to say a couple of things. We didn't say what it was that she was singing. And at least one of the songs that I caught, she was talking about, I hide my tears, and it's a pain, it's a song of pain and lament and nostalgia, which was very, I guess everybody can identify with nostalgia, but I remember being a child with listening to, hearing it as the women of the family listened, and life in those days was segregated, not in a nasty way, frankly, and women would get together in a large group and enjoy listening to music together. And I recall this as one of the great pleasures of time. And also,
let me just stop you there because we have to take a short break. But this is an important part of understanding the appeal of the woman. And so when we come back, Connection listeners, more about Asmahan, more about Princess Amal Al-Atrash. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd love to have you join this conversation as we take a listen back to a time when the cultures were speaking to each other perhaps more than they are today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, a chance to listen to the music of Asmahan, also known as Princess Al-Atrash, from the 1930s, the 1940s, in Cairo, a window in on that city at a time when it was celebrating its independence, despite the fact that it was under such colonial control that we look back on now. And perhaps we, before we return to the conversation, a chance to listen again to a little bit of music of the singer Asmahan. the voice of Asmahan in an old recording, you can tell. With me on the hour, on the program this hour, Sharifa Zahur, author of a book, Asmahan Secrets, Woman, War, and Song, and Leila Ahmed, who is a professor of divinity at Harvard's School of Divinity. Just before we go back to Sharifa, Leila, take me back into this segregated life when you were listening to that music as a little girl.
Yes, well, it was certainly a much more optimistic time, I think. And so, when we were talking on the issue of women, Asmahan had the reputation of being very daring. She had broken all kinds of taboos to become a singer out in the acting world.
In a naughty, bratty way like Britney Spears, or in a more sort of respectable way for her time and age?
Well, as I recall it, in a more respectable way, because she was certainly embraced and looked up to by the women among whom I lived, who were very respectable, not only proper women who obeyed the role of being...
So they admired her for being a bit of a renegade.
They did. There was a kind of, sub-feminist admiration of this woman who dared divide... defy the rules of the game, you know.
Sharifa, what was your first connection with this woman? You yourself are a singer and a performer. Was it with the music or hearing her?
Yes, it was with the music. I actually learned some of her brother Farid's compositions first. And then I heard the one song that we may play later that has a tango, and dropped whatever I was holding and said, "Who's that?" And then, you know, everyone I would ask, people older than me in the Arab community, had a slightly different story about her. And that just intrigued me. And then I decided to really look into it. And I found that... there were two sort of important biographies written in Arabic, one by her own brother, which was to clear her of certain accusations made by a journalist. And the journalist seemed to have been in love with her. That's the impression he gave in his book. And there were so many mistakes and contradictions in the two stories that drew me in even further. So it was a big investigation. I wanted to see.
So did you decide if she was a good, bad girl or a bad, good girl? I mean, she's a little bit of the siren and the seductress, but she seems to have... You know, in her 26 years, gone through four marriages, who knows how many affairs, and yet still retain some dignity, some respect as a performer.
Well, I think she was only a slightly bad good girl in that, you know, she was married off to her cousin, which, you know, a traditional arranged marriage to prevent her from entering the entertainment world. So she began singing. She had a number of important breaks. And then all of a sudden, her elder brother was panicked and married her off. And she married her cousin and she went back home and she did what women are supposed to do. And she managed to return to Cairo through tricking him. She was going to give birth to her daughter, and she wanted to be with her mother. And she returned to Cairo, and then she just didn't go back. So
you've mentioned her brother a couple of times. Let me just stop you for half a second, Sharifa. We'll continue with her story in a minute. But we have a caller on the line from Boston. Yuval is calling about Asmahan's brother. Is that right, Yuval?
Yeah, that's right. I actually called before he was mentioned because I was surprised that he wasn't mentioned thus far. I grew up in Israel where we have a sort of an indirect connection with Arabic music, though many of us love it. And I've heard of Farid al-Atrash many years before I've heard of Asmahan as one of the greatest composers of Arabic music. And I'm curious what their relationship was and how much he was involved in all of the stuff that you're mentioning.
It's a great question because, Sharifa, if my reading is correct, it was a pretty stormy relationship, sometimes very close and sometimes really angry with each other.
Well, she had two brothers. So the brother who married her off was the elder brother, and I interviewed him several times when he was 93 years old, just before he died. Farid is much better known than Esmahan by the younger generation, particularly that would be true in Israel, because he lived until 1975, so decade after decade of recordings and 31 films. And Esmahan's two films were re-shown for a long time on television, and they can be seen in video. But she died in 1944, so there's that difference. In a book about Arabic music by an important critic in Egypt, Farid al-Atrash was cut out of the list of the seven most important composers, and there's sort of interesting opinion that his sister was a much greater singer than he. And in the beginning of their careers, he played in the band that backed her up, and she was the important voice. And when she returned to Cairo to have her daughter, she began singing, and she sang his compositions on the radio, making them famous for the first time. She made a deal to obtain him his first film role, so they starred together in a film called The Triumph of Youth, in English, and he wouldn't have been hired. It was only through her pressure. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic that, the male singer becomes the one who is better known. After her death, she fades from memory, and he actually couldn't find another partner to sing with. He made a few films with another singer who sang in a somewhat similar style, and then 9 films with a dancer instead of a singer. This is an interesting tradition in show business in general, is brothers and sisters, family members performing together.
Yuval, do you hear the brother and the sisters singing?
I haven't yet to hear them, but I'd be very curious to hear it.
No, just I meant the family connection there.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I do, certainly. It's very beautiful.
I want to play one more piece of music here. We'll try and get as much in it as we can, but this one caught my ear. Imta Hatharaf, I think, is as close as I'm going to get to pronouncing it accurately. But when I was listening to it last night, of course, the music's going along, and then I realize when a man starts talking in the background on the telephone, I'm sure he's on the phone, we're listening to something which is from the film.
سامع الكلام إلك يا جارة.
حضرتك بتكلم؟
نعم. لا غلطان يا بي، عم بقروش بحكي مع حالي.
I get a sort of Maltese Falcon chill up the back as I listen to that.
That's actually not a man on the telephone.
What am I listening to then, Sharifa?
You're listening to a famous comedian, a very funny actor named Bishara Wakim, and he plays the comic relief in this movie. The heroine is singing at a party for a Bedouin sheikh, and they've traveled from Egypt to the East, and she's entertaining this whole party, and the comedian is sitting next to the hero, who is a violinist and also a great musician, and he's captivated by her singing, and he's elbowing him, and he says, "Hey, man, she's singing to you." That's what you're hearing, the conversation.
When we look at the role of the actor and the actress in films from that era, Leila, did the women have the standing that the men had? Were they the, you know, let's cut away to the entertainment part now while someone sings a song and then we'll go back to the action driven by the men? Or did the women have a standing, a profile on the screen?
Well, as I recall it, so I'm speaking from memory again, yeah. I think it was actually the women led. I mean, I think of films by Asma Khan and Umm Kulthum, that they were the films were driven by the women, the heroines, rather than the males. So I don't really see them. I think it was actually a very liberated era in relation to women. And it might be comparable to what was going on in America. I don't know.
Do you take notions of feminism today back to try and understand what was going on with strong, powerful, sort of success-driven women like Asma Khan then?
Yes, we do. I think, well, I mean, I guess it's difficult because the whole, of course, we do take notions, but it's intriguing to me as watching things from 1920s and 30s,
yeah,
that women did have the roles and this, and there was much more support for women's liberation then than in succeeding decades anyway. So it's it was a time, and I think it may be a global matter. You know, this was in the 1910s that American women got the vote, and I think this reverberated across the world, you know. And I think actually for women in America too, the 1920s and 30s were easier than the 50s in some ways, or more, at least officially more feminist, more openly feminist.
You think of the power of someone like Marlene Dietrich, who, yes, you know, was able to straddle those two cultures,
that's
but
right,
have the power in both and still captivate men and women,
yes,
alike. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to Brookline, Massachusetts now, and Frederick's calling us. Frederick, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I just call in with a comment. I grew up in Algeria, and I remember in my childhood it was kind of mystical on weekends, sitting down with my mom to watch Egyptian movies, and my favorites were the ones with Asma Khan, because it was this sort of a musical going on, and it was very interesting.
Why did she stand out for you? What was it about Asma Khan that makes you remember her, lo, these many years?
I think it was the combination of the beauty of both voice and physical beauty as well.
She was quite stunning.
And indeed.
You had a crush on her, Frederick? You can confess to us.
But who didn't? Once you get hooked, once you see her, you're sort of under the spell. I actually discovered something which I never knew. I never realized she was a Farid al-Atrash sister, which I find very interesting.
I think part of her appeal, you know, might have been exactly this feminist edge that to her work, because it was, she was a woman being publicly shown breaking rules and yet remaining within the, what was in some way still acceptable. So I think for a lot of people there was an edge of the attraction of this, of being able to be a woman out in public doing things, mm-hmm, and being a professional woman. All of this was subliminally very important, I think, to why she was so attractive, as well as the fact that she was beautiful and had a wonderful voice.
Sharifa, what are you thinking now?
I'm thinking exactly the same thing. I'm thinking of the, you know, the impact of this film all over the Arab world. So in Algeria, he's called in. In Morocco, I have friends who loved her and were captivated by the stories of the two films are very different. But the second one, and there are little things. She wore slacks in one scene in Gharam wa Intiqam, women didn't do that. She defends the hero. She hires lawyers for him, and she defends him, and they have sort of a very mod progression of newspaper headings and the problems of the trial. And then I think it was all capped off with her death, because that reverberated in all the rumors and stories and things that she did were repeated.
That's an interesting part of understanding the appeal of the woman in that time, because it's hard for me to know, looking back now, whether or not she would have as much appeal for her her own personal life being as dramatic and as exciting and sexy, and maybe she was a spy and maybe she wasn't, and maybe she died in a mysterious car crash. And, you know, we think of what happened just a few years ago when Princess Diana died in a mysterious car crash, and what it did to her profile around the world. Were there those two parallel tracks going on? One, the sort of radio and screen presence, and the other, this dramatic personal story?
I think so. Very dramatic. Now, some part of this may have been, you know, the public relations that the entertainment industry drummed up for its stars, and that began quite early. I mean, that the putting in the newspaper the fact that she might have been asked to leave Egypt when she left Egypt because people couldn't understand why. So I think her death absolutely raised her to this cult status, you know, something like Marilyn Monroe. And they put it into the movie. They weren't done filming the second movie. So they changed the end of the movie, and they have the heroine, Suher, dies in a car accident.
Can I just check the facts, though? Did her chauffeur really drive the car into a canal and manage to escape, but she died? Is that what happened?
He opened the door, fell out, his leg was broken. She and her companion, a lady friend, were in the back seat, and they both drowned. There was water in the ditch, and, you know, so they died, and he escaped. And from that, a number of rumors were spun.
Was
he paid to crash the car? Did somebody pay him to, you know, take this opportunity?
It was July 1944, and it was also a time when there were fascinating things going on politically in that area, with the British and the French competing during wartime. We'll talk a little bit more about how to place it in a larger context, her story, when we come back after this break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join our conversation about Asma Khan. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Asma Khan's Secret, Woman, War, and Song. It's a book written by Sherifa Zuhur, who is one of my guests this hour. We're talking about this mysterious woman of Cairo in the 1930s and the 1940s, trying to understand a little bit more about her and that time and the relationship of the cultures and the empires. Leila Ahmed is with me in the studio. She's a professor of divinity at Harvard School of Divinity. She's author of a recent book called A Border Passage from Cairo to America, Woman's Journey. And our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd love to have you in on this conversation. We're going to go to Boston, and Magid is joining us. Magid, thanks for calling.
Thank you. This call actually is to thank you, mainly. To give you an idea, I'm driving to Boston, and on 93, and I turned the radio on, and I'm listening to Asma Khan, and I thought something's wrong, and I kept scanning the radio to get back to NPR. And it is really absolutely fascinating, not only because of the subject and the beautiful voices, and I want to thank you and thank Dr. Leila Ahmed and Ms. Sherifa. Asma Khan has such a beautiful voice. I'm not old enough to be a contemporary, but I was a child. I was born 2 years after she died. But her voice resonates with all of us.
Did your father play the music, Magid? Did your mother play the music?
The radio played the music. We didn't have the equipment
replay
or records or stuff like that. So the radio played the music, and her brother continued after that, Farid al-Atrash. The irony, there's also an irony in the name Atrash, and I think you two guests can comment on it. But last night, Robert McNamara was at Harvard, and he was talking about his movie and book. And he was saying, I wonder how many of us, he was lamenting, how little we know about Islamic and Arabic culture. And here, this morning, I am on NPR listening to this. So I'm fascinated, and this is the America I know. I want to thank you both, all of you, for that.
I want to thank you for your call.
And there is a song, I wonder if...
Uh-oh. I don't know how many we have here.
I think it's Asman's... Layali al-Uns fi Vienna, the nights of evening and the of joy and pleasure in Vienna. I wonder if it is part of the record you guys have there. If it is hers.
It's actually not one that we have ready for the program, but I promise you, Magid, if you stay with us, we'll get to some more music. I need to check with Sharif or Leila on Al Atrash. What's the pun I'm missing there, Leila?
It means deaf.
Oh, I didn't know.
Atrash, yes.
Okay, the princess of death?
Well, no, the D-E-A-F.
Oh, deaf?
Deaf.
Okay, interesting. For someone with such a beautiful
voice. That's right,
1-800-423-8255. Sharifa, you must find that after having sort of written a book about her and talked about her here in this country, you must have been struck by the number of people like Magid who say, yes, she actually had an important place in my childhood or in my family when I was growing up.
Absolutely. Philip Khoury at MIT reminded me that he told me when he was growing up, his father used to sing Esmahan's music in the shower all the time. And he finally asked him, what is that? Why are you singing that over and over again? My mentor, my dissertation chair, grew up in Egypt as well. And Esmahan actually came to her home, and she can recall her singing just to entertain the family when she was a little child eating her soup. And everybody told me their own personal story and their own memory.
I feel like we should listen to just a little bit more music here. This one is Ana Bintu El Nili. That means, Leila, I am daughter of the Nile.
Yeah. Or I'm Egyptian. I mean, I'm of this place of the Nile, in other words, you know.
Ana Bintu El Nili, Ukhtu El Harami, قد صحبت الدهر منذ القدم من هلي عذب وأرضي جنة تتناغى في ظلال النعم مواكب العز مرت علي عبر السنين فكان أنظر عصر ملأت منه عيوني عصر انتهى.
1-800-423-8255. We're going to Swampscott, Massachusetts. Adil is listening to the music along with us. Are you enjoying it, Adil?
Oh, I loved it. I was singing along, actually, too. I am so happy, and thank you. Thank you for this program, actually, first of all, and thank you for all this effort that you guys are doing for, sending the message to everyone and understand it and share it with everybody else.
Take me back to the politics of that time, Adil. It's a more interesting story than just the appreciation of an artist, though, isn't it?
Yes. And there is actually an enigma of Esmahan itself. And she was actually known by Esmahan only, not Esmahan Atrash.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure. I'm going to say because, but it was no because. When I was a child, my mom, she used to listen to this music all the time, and she will tell me the stories about Esmahan that when she was actually in Lebanon and she escaped from Lebanon with her brother Farid Atrash, and because of the politics there. And the question, I'm not sure if it's true or not. And now it's like some revealing. It's like she was a spy and all this kind of thing. It's just to make the connections and, on the whole story that my mom used to tell me. And my question again, my question now, that for Leila Ahmed, I think.
Yeah.
Is that actually because they escaped? For reaching, for becoming actually an actor.
Let's let Leila in here on this one.
Well, what I was thinking, I think you may be right, but what I was thinking is about the ambiguity of the words and the songs in relation to the whole feminist issue. You know, for instance, one of the songs we heard said Ahwa, which means two things. It means coffee in Arabic, but it also means I love. And one of the...
Ana Ahwa means I love or I love. Am coffee?
Ana Ahwa means I love, but the word Ahwa means coffee. So there's a slight ambiguity there. And one of the things we're seeing is a woman pursuing her love, whether in Asmahan's life or in her song. And that is the one forbidden thing, you know, certainly back then. So I'm sure that that was one of the appeals, that this was really out in the open, slightly veiled, but out in the open. And that she was actually living this as well as singing about it.
But the double entendres were intentional. Sharifa, I want you to help me with the spying part of it now, because I see in the book you have a fabulous photograph of this woman wearing the Croix de la Reine, the symbol of the Free French. But was she British? Because she was, you know, was she sort of with the British and the Free French because she was in Egypt? Was she inclined towards the other side of the Axis? Where did she fit in the 40s?
Okay, you have to remember right at that point, Syria and Lebanon had been taken over by the new regime, the Vichy French, because France had been captured. In Egypt, you had the British and the Free French under de Gaulle came there to try and raise support for their cause. And when that picture was taken, she had just gone to hear de Gaulle speak at Ewart Hall at the American University in Cairo. And she wore the pin to show her support for the cause. And just about that time, she was contacted and asked to carry out a mission for the British and the Free French. And she was paid £40,000 for this.
Wow, that's a lot of money
That's a lot of money then. And she took off. You could go by train then to the east. She went to Palestine. And from Palestine, she traveled to the Syrian border. And what she was supposed to do was to contact her own family, being leaders in their area, and tell them that the British and the Free French forces were going to invade and that they should not fight them. And some parts of the family didn't get the message and actually fought.
Why would they trust the message to someone with such a high profile, though?
Because she had that high profile. Because she was the cousin of Sultan al-Atrash, the leader of the revolution against the French back in the 1920s. And, you know, her word would not be doubted. If she went to her relatives and they told the others, they would know they were really going to invade. And the Free French promised the Syrians and the Lebanese their independence
Such a fabulous detective story. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Let's go to a call from Marlborough, Massachusetts. And George is with us. George, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I was just curious as to what sort of music this is. This is secular music of an Arabic culture, and this woman was Druze, and I'm just wondering what the interplay between the various cultures in the area and the music. The music seems to be cultural, and yet there would be differences, and I was wondering if there was much of an interchange or a division between who was listening to what.
It's a great question. Sharifa, would we equate it with pop music today?
We could equate it with, it was the pop music of its day. Just prior to this, the music was what we'd have to call it Arabo-Turkic or Arabo-Ottoman music, a classical form that was popular. And then with the advent of radio, particularly radio, but also films, more people could hear the music, and it's secular and popular music. I don't think that very many people knew, even in Egypt, when Esmahan began singing, that she was a Druze, or even really necessarily, you know, who the Druze were, their special place in history. Singers and entertainers were of all religious backgrounds and did usually often a mixed national background. Although we just heard her sing, Ana Binti Nil, I'm an Egyptian too. So another thing about Esmahan is she's very pan-Arab, and there are all kinds of moments in the songs and in her films in which that's pronounced, that we're all cousins in this region. And
it was also a time, Leila, when Pan-Arabism was being born, was it not?
It was indeed. An interesting thing about whether she was Egyptian, I mean, the whole issue of Egyptian, we recall that the Ottoman Empire only ended in after the First World War,
right.
And there was no Egyptian nationality until the late 1920s. So the idea of an identity, Syrian or Egyptian, or was a national identity, was just being born at that point, as was Arab nationalism itself.
And I'm curious about the other part of George's question, though, and that is, would there have been people forbidden to listen to this music for fear that they would stop praying or that they would, you know, become drinkers and gamblers? Did it have that?
There must have been, but I really never came across them in Egypt. I mean, I'm sure Saudi Arabia probably, but the notion of secular music, It's we were embedded in it, and I don't recall anyone ever saying you're not allowed to listen to this. I do recall that with the other singer, Umm Kulthum, she was forbidden to chant the Quran because they decided it was improper for a woman's voice to chant the sacred text. In the Egyptian context, music was not prohibited at all, secular music.
Sharitha, it was a moment when the cultures were speaking to each other, wasn't it?
Yeah, I should mention Esmahan and Farid. Esmahan sang some religious songs. There's a famous song that is to celebrate the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. And that was a popular song. So yes, bridging cultures and crossing boundaries.
Sharitha, I want to thank you so much for bringing Esmahan to our radio show today. You obviously touched a nerve. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sharitha Zuhoor is author of Esmahan Secret, Woman, War, and Song. Leila Ahmed, it's great to have you back in the studio.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Leila's professor at Harvard's Divinity School. We're going to go out with that tango piece that we were talking about a little bit earlier in the program. And it's called Ya Habibi Talal. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
يا حبيبي تعال الحقني شوف اللي جرالي من بعدك سهرانة من وجدي بناجي خيالي